Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs here at Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, education, aging, and the environment. We're going to open spreading the word about Safe Connect, a brand new and comprehensive service through the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence that allows individuals threatened with domestic and intimate partner violence to immediately access extensive information, safety planning, counseling, and case management, as well as referrals to one of CCADV's 18-member organizations and community resources. Then we're going to chat with Connecticut's Consumer Protection Commissioner and the CEO of CT Pharma, one of the state's medicinal marijuana suppliers, about the first of what is hoped to be an ongoing series of studies on medical marijuana and its effectiveness for individuals with myriad health and anxiety concerns that recently got underway at the Yale School of Medicine. And we'll close learning about Connecticut Housing Partners, a nonprofit that's been creating and sustaining innovative housing, revitalizing neighborhoods, and enhancing the quality of life for low and moderate income residents for almost three decades. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. While Friday, November 15th was America Recycles Day, any day is a good day to recycle your unused and old mattresses and box springs. The Mattress Recycling Council's Bye Bye Mattress Connecticut program collected more than 680,000 mattresses and 11,000 tons of material has been recycled since it was established in May 2015. Today, Bye Bye Mattress Recycling is available at 139 collection locations throughout the state absolutely free. So if you've got plans to replace or dispose of one or more mattresses or box springs this winter, find out where you can easily recycle them by visiting buybuymattress.com. It's been way too long since we rang up Karen Jarmuck. She's CEO of the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, CCADV, a longtime partner and resource for the award-winning For the People, and some very, very exciting news coming out of CCADV over the past couple of weeks. The launch of their newest initiative, which is called Safe Connect, that went live on November 1st. Safe Connect is designed to allow Connecticut to streamline the many access points that currently exist for survivors of domestic violence seeking services into one comprehensive statewide triage and response system. We are actually going to be talking with the Safe Connect supervisor, Terry Alamo, in just a few minutes. But first, Karen, welcome back to the program, and thanks so much for taking a few minutes to chat with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So tell us the lead up to this launch. Was it just a case of there being way too many options or situations where people needed to go or response initiatives people needed to experience when they were in that moment of crisis?
Well, we know that in the state of Connecticut, domestic violence is a very serious issue. And that is underscored by the fact that historically there are approximately 33,000 calls annually to domestic violence hotlines in the state. And the challenge was that there were 18 separate hotlines associated with the 18 separate domestic violence service organizations, along with a statewide Spanish and English hotline. And we took about a year and a half working with advocates and survivors to understand how could we do better, what would make more sense around access and availability and cultural responsiveness. And so the idea of Safe Connect emulated from that. And basically, it's the opportunity where survivors of domestic violence can email, live chat, text, or call for help 24/7. 70% of the staff on the Safe Connect project are bilingual in Spanish, and the other 30% speak multiple other languages.
That's excellent. So the how does the coordination of all of these many avenues to seek support or intervention combine into one? Was this a long lead-up process, or were there already a lot of tools in place that helped ease the launch of Safe Connect?
We really had to develop this project from both a service providing standpoint and also technology. And I'm sure Terry can talk with you a little bit about the technology piece and the services. But through the Victims of Crime Act, our organization received a nearly $3 million commitment to fund Safe Connect annually. And it's really opening the door around language and access. An advocate just 2 days ago who speaks Urdu did a call with a victim who speaks Urdu. That's very unique and very important when we're talking about representing and serving communities who speak different languages. And there are obviously barriers associated with various non-English speaking communities around access and a fearfulness. And if we can ensure that they are feeling comfortable with who they are speaking with and connecting with, that's enormously important.
And so this really is going to have the opportunity to provide the most immediate intervention and support for the potentially the largest and growing number of folks here in Connecticut, many of whom English is not their their first language.
Yeah, what's really unique about Safe Connect is that again, it's a multicultural, bilingual Safe Connect coordinator staff that are responding to these calls for assistance. And in addition to that, for example, someone can text in their own language. It comes to the advocate in English, and then it goes back out to the survivor in the language that they sent the message in. And so the whole platform offers us some unique opportunities. What's been really interesting in the first 2 weeks of this project is that survivors are selecting to live chat with an advocate at the same amount as they are calling. And that's really interesting given that we haven't even formally launched the public awareness campaign associated with this project.
And to that end, and before we hand the phone over and talk with Terry Alamo, part of what we might be able to do is help you connect to other individuals and organizations that are trying to spread the word. And to that end, you've developed a Safe Connect awareness toolkit for partners to help build awareness and to promote the program, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So individuals can go on our website, the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and the toolkit is available there. Also, if individuals are interested in viewing the Safe Connect tool, they can go to www.ctsafeconnect.org. And it's a very easy platform where you can simply click to text, to live chat, to email, or you can be on a phone call with an advocate.
Excellent. Well, Karen Jermak, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to set us up on this exciting new program. The Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence has always been on the front line in developing initiatives, kind of always trying to think of where the ball is going to be. And this certainly is evidence that that initiative is continuing with your organization. Really excited to be able to talk to a Safe Connect supervisor. So we'll say farewell to you and we'll meet Terry Alamo. Karen, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And Terry is also, if it would be helpful, she is joined by one of the Safe Connect coordinator advocates who is bilingual and who's been talking with survivors over the past week. Her name is Vanessa Guzzati, and I know they would be happy to speak with you.
Great. Well, let's get on the line now with Terry Alamo. Folks, if you just joined us, we are talking about Safe Connect, a brand new initiative from the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence that just launched on November 1st, taking a number of the statewide hotlines and centralizing them into a system where counselors can become available by phone, text, chat, and email 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. Terry Alamo is on the line with us. Terry, great to meet you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you're a Safe Connect supervisor, and you're there with Vanessa Gazzardi, who we initially were going to talk to, but then she got an emergency call, and this is how it works with you guys. From your perspective as a supervisor in the first few days, really, that this program is rolling out, Karen's already kind of alluded that it's almost getting ahead of itself in terms of success. All the buttons are working. And you guys are actively helping people with Safe Connect, right?
Yes, that's correct. Vanessa is one of our coordinators, and you know, I watch our advocates as they work, and they're chatting. You know, they're talking on the phone. These coordinators, they're available 24/7, and the fact that we have texting now and chat, that makes such a big difference. You know, not everybody can get to a phone. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, this program is just amazing.
Very good. And it has been, when they flipped the switch on November 1st, folks were able to get through and get the help they needed, no matter where they were calling, texting, or emailing from.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, if you don't mind passing the phone over to Vanessa. We will greet her on the front lines of Safe Connect is one of their coordinators, Vanessa Gazzardi. Vanessa, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us for a few minutes.
Thank you so much for having me.
So in these last couple minutes that we have with you on this segment this morning, and I do want to extend thanks not only on behalf of all of us here at Connoisseur Media who have worked so hard to support the coalition and all their initiatives for the more than quarter century I've been involved with the program. It's folks like you who really save lives and change lives. So thank you so much for the work that you're doing. You literally, we didn't know we were going to talk to you, but you ended up getting a call. Tell us about what folks can expect when they connect with Safe Connect.
Well, somebody that is available for them at that moment, at the moment that is hard for them, we listen, we understand, we empathize with their situation, and we're willing to help them in the way that they need to. You have to understand that victims already know what they need. Mm-hmm. So by not attacking them with a lot of ideas and stuff that comes from us and just listening and providing them the tools to solve their situation, that is a big thing for them. Mm-hmm. They really feel that we have their backs. That's how they feel.
Mm-hmm. And in the short time that you've been working in the Safe Connect system, have you actually had the opportunity to interact with people in all of the ways that they can reach you? Have you had the phone, texts, chats, and emails?
Exactly. It's been quite an experience for me. And just to know that they have several ways to approach us. It gives you peace, you know, because not all people have access to the phone in a safe way. Mm-hmm. So that allows us to help them in a better way as well.
So for folks that are listening that either may have unfortunately had to call a hotline before, or for those who are in a situation that they want to get out of, what is the best way for them to get in touch with you or one of the other frontline people through Safe Connect?
So they can reach us at our phones. It's 888-774-2900 in English, 844-831-9200 in Spanish. And they can also access ctsafeconnect.com and chat with us. You know, we're there and our names are going to be showing up so they know who they're talking to. They know they're in a safe space. And nobody has to listen to what they're saying. So, you know, they can be sitting in a living room and the abuser can be around and they don't know what's going on. It's a very good way for them to communicate with us.
Well, that's excellent. Well, I'm excited to hear about this new development and how the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence is so much on the front line, as we said to Terry Alamo. And we thank you once again for your great work and the work that you're going to be doing going forward. Vanessa Gazzardi with us, along with Terry Alamo and Karen Jarmak, all representing the Connecticut Coalition Against Against Domestic Violence, serving as Connecticut's domestic violence information hub. Their brand new program, Safe Connect, is providing victims with extensive information, safety planning, counseling, and case management, as well as referrals to one of the CCADV's 18 member organizations and community resources. Vanessa, thank you so much for your time and your colleagues' time this morning. Well, we're starting off the first of these couple of segments with our Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection Commissioner, Michelle Seagull. She's been a great guest for us before, bringing us all kinds of great resources on our program. And today we're talking about a brand new Yale School of Medicine medical marijuana study. Good morning, Michelle. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's go to the backstory on this. Tell us a little bit about how the thought behind trying to initiate this study came about.
Okay, so one of the great things about Connecticut's medical marijuana program is it truly is a medical program, and we've really always stayed focused on staying as true as possible to the medical piece of this. And so while medical marijuana became legal in Connecticut in 2012, it became fairly apparent as the program progressed and feedback from physicians and other prescribers that there needed to be more research and that some doctors were just not as comfortable with patients using this without research. And so in 2016, medical marijuana bill, it was updated, and it really created an infrastructure so that the Department of Consumer Protection could approve research studies within the program. And so that was great, and a number of both the licensees and then also other either healthcare facilities or institutes of higher education have really taken advantage of that and have started to look at how can we study this as medicine.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, did you say there was legislation necessary to enable the department to create that umbrella under which these studies could happen?
Yeah, so that was an important piece of it, because the way the medical marijuana program initially worked, the only people who were allowed to have access to marijuana were patients or the businesses that manufactured and sold this medicine. And so what we wanted to do is create an infrastructure where research facilities or maybe people who were going to be study subjects could also have legal access to marijuana. But we also want to make sure if research is happening that it's being done in a really robust way, the same way you'd expect of studies involving any other medicine that people are going to take. You know, the safety of these products is really important. We have a population of people who have serious debilitating conditions. And so it's really important to us that whatever the medicine they're taking is safe and that studies are showing its effectiveness.
So if I understand correctly, then it is not just individuals who have already been provided with state authorization to obtain and use medical marijuana who will participate in these studies.
Well, it depends, and you would have to talk to Yale as to whether they're using existing patients or not for their study. I don't know the specific details of that, but the way the research program is set up is it would allow, through an approved research study, somebody could be registered with us as a research subject. And that would what that does is creates an opportunity. There are conditions out there where there's maybe some anecdotal evidence or there's some general belief that medical marijuana would be helpful, but the science isn't there to justify adding it to the list of conditions. And so what we wanted to do is allow this research to take place. So then as our Board of Physicians is considering whether new conditions should be added, there would be some science there for them to look at.
Great. Well, tell us a little bit about developing the partnerships under which the studies that have begun so far have kind of rolled out.
So it's really being done, it's not being done at the Department of Consumer Protection.
Right.
So there's no, you know, state funds that are being involved in this. It's not state resources. What we're doing is we're looking at what's the study look like and making sure it meets the requirements for what we think is going to be a valid medical study. And if it is, we approve it. And so there's different ways that these studies can be developed. This one is with one of the producers who manufactures marijuana, is partnering with the Yale School of Medicine. And together they've established what this research program should look like. We've looked over how they're conducting the study, what they're looking at, making sure, in our mind, it has the kind of robustness that you would expect for somebody who's studying a product to be used as medicine.
But this is not the first study that has occurred or begun under this kind of Department of Consumer Protection oversight.
Correct. This is actually the fourth study. So it's been really good to see, since this law passed a few years ago, there really has been an interest in doing this research. And again, because we require it to be real research, the kind of research you'd expect of other medicines, these are not easy things to get off the ground, but this is the fourth one. And so we're really excited that we're having places like Yale and other, you know, institutes of higher education really taking an interest in studying this product in a really serious way.
Mm. Now, is this a situation where, because it is sort of known in the industry and in the academic communities, that those posing research pitches and ideas come to the Department of Consumer Protection, or have you and your staff been faced with repetitive or escalating questions or concerns, either in the front line at the distribution point for medical marijuana consumers, or in the process of developing and getting new conditions approved? Who goes to who in regards to, say, initiating the first couple of studies that have already rolled out?
And generally, these things, it really happens through conversations. Generally, anybody who's really serious about kind of medical marijuana research, they're aware of DCP's role. So sometimes they may come to us with a fully formed idea, or it may come out of conversations that they may have with us. Our program is being run through our drug control division, which regulates other pharmaceuticals in the state as well. And so the type of people who are interested in this sort of medical research are familiar with our agency, are familiar with our staff. And so how precisely they evolve, it's through conversations, but generally somebody has an idea of something they want to study, and in working with us, get something put together that we can approve.
And does each study kind of proceed on its own in terms of making connections and developing and then getting the clearance? Or is there like a standard template or application process that has to occur that's the same with each study proposal?
So there's ultimately, once you sort of have your idea formed, there is a process, and the first step in that process is to obtain DCP approval for the research program. Mm-hmm. And so the types of things, we do have an online application. We're going to ask who's the lead research institution, who are the investigators. We're going to want a synopsis of the study, understand the research protocol. If they're going to be using an outside lab, we'll want to know what lab that is. The duration of the study, how many participants. We really want to get all of that. We require that there be an institutional review board, and so we want to understand who are the members of that. So it's a pretty, you know, robust application, and we expect people to come to us with a really serious, thought-out research program.
Mm-hmm. In the last minute or so that we have with you, Commissioner Siegel, tell us a little bit about how you are looking at the future of this program. Have there been any concerns or issues that have come to light that you're hoping to see come under more robust research if a partner develops in the future?
We're comfortable and really actually pleased with the path that our medical program's been going on. We're helping now approaching 40,000 patients. We've got over 1,000 certifying, you know, doctors or APRNs who are taking part in the program. And so the fact that we'd love to continue seeing studies, and we think just like any medicine people take, the more it's been looked at and studied for its effectiveness, its safety, the better. And I think the medical community as well will become increasingly more comfortable with this product as a medicine if there's more science out there. And so we're excited to see that type of research happening, and proud that Connecticut has the type of program that supports that.
Are you already seeing other states or counties or municipalities kind of looking over your shoulder at what Connecticut is doing, where what is happening in your office can serve as a model for other states that have medical marijuana programs?
Yeah, I think a number of other states did, especially when we first launched our program. We were very unique in maintaining a role for pharmacists in the program and really modeling it not off of maybe a recreational model that where you need a certification, but really modeling it off a pharmaceutical model. And I think a number of states who came after us have gone more down that path, where early adopters of medical marijuana had much looser standards. And I think a number of people have tightened them up, and we were early in doing that.
Excellent. I appreciate your time this morning and kind of orienting us to how the Department of Consumer Protection's role plays out in this program. We're going to take a quick break and then go and speak with Connecticut CT Pharma about the study itself. So in the meantime, thank you so much for giving us some time. Our Connecticut Consumer Protection Commissioner Michelle Siegel on the line with us for this part of the interview this morning. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Hey, I know some of us are still dragging as the end of daylight savings time arrived a little while ago, and AAA Northeast wants to remind drivers and commuters that as this earlier darkness looms, motor vehicle and pedestrian crashes on Connecticut roadways have spiked. To avoid crashes after the time change has gone into effect, AAA Northeast suggests drivers follow at safe driving distances to have time to react. Understand decreased visibility affects depth perception and peripheral vision. Approach crosswalks and intersections with care. Check for cyclists and pedestrians before turning and anticipate pedestrians crossing mid-block. You also need to adjust your speed to compensate for low light conditions and maintain your vehicle so your headlights, taillights, and signals work properly. If you'd like more seasonal driving and vehicle maintenance tips, all you need to do is visit AAANortheast.com. We are now on the line with Tom Schultz. He's CEO of CT Pharma. Since 2014, CT Pharma has provided top-quality marijuana products to improve patients' lives. They're licensed to grow and process medicinal marijuana products for adults and pediatric patients and invest in best practices to ensure that patients have access to effective options. Tom, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. I'm happy to be here.
So we heard from Commissioner Siegel sort of the DCP's role in all of this. Beyond the introduction, just tell us a little bit more about CT Pharma and your history in doing research along with purveying the medicinal products.
Certainly. We applied for a license to the DCP in 2013. We got the award in February of 14 and began delivering before the end of 2014. In 2014, however, under Connecticut's enabling legislation, research was not allowed. It wasn't part of the legislation. So beginning in 2014, we worked with the DCP and with the support of the DCP. By 2016, research had been added to the legislation by the Connecticut State Legislature. So that for us was the beginning of this effort, which we're extremely happy with. From our point of view, there's been a 50-year gap in research, at least a 50-year gap, that is since 1970 at least. There's been a lot of, let's say, resistance from various, especially federal agencies, to clinical research. And we saw this as a big opportunity. That is, we know that this product interacts with with a human biological system, and we know that a lot of people, as they say anecdotally, have claimed great benefit from it. So it left the door, it left the question open as to whether one could prove the medicinal benefits, and that's what we're working on. That is what we're, like any other producer, we have stories of individuals who have benefited. We're trying to take it to the next step and say, okay, this is the way in which we might prove the benefits for a specific set of conditions and bring the product out of the range of stories about individuals and into the range of medicine and pharmacy and conventional practice in the United States.
And is the study that we're hearing about over the past few days that is happening at Yale, is this among the first studies that you are partnering on, or have you done a number of them up to now?
No, this is the first clinical study. This has taken an enormous amount of effort, time, and money. And so this is the first.
So tell us a little bit about ramping up to that and kind of making that partnership with the with Yale.
Well, the most important, we go back to the character of the program that we have in Connecticut. From the DCP and from the legislature, we have a program that emphasizes that the production of product in the program meet federal standards. So even though the federal government's not involved, Connecticut adopted federal regulations that participants in this program, that producers in this program, have to meet. Once we met those standards, let's say the leadership of this company came from pharmaceutical production, so that as we began operating in medical marijuana, we produced our products in conformity with federal standards, just as if we were making a pharmaceutical product that would go into a pharmacy for prescription. And that's where, without that type of program and that type of production, the clinical study wouldn't be possible. But given that that's the way we were going, we were able then to meet other federal requirements for clinical studies, and that in working with Yale, we were able to bring forward our production standards and our records, and through Yale and through the Yale's work with the FDA, get approval for this study.
So in the last few minutes that we have with you, Mr. Schultz, tell us about the study and what is hoped to come from it.
Well, this is a phase one study. All phase one studies are basically safety studies. If for whatever reason one were to find that a drug under consideration were not safe, the study would stop. Mm-hmm. The phase one study here is of pain and stress, but once we get through phase one and prove safety, the pain and stress focus of phase one may well expand into questions that questions of conditions like PTSD or issues like opioid replacement, but we can't get to those further questions until we get through the phase one phase safety study. And right now we're in the phase one safety study. The big news though is that we are here at all.
Yes. Yes. How many participants do you have? Can you reveal that information?
Sure. In phase one, it's approximately 20.
And
phase two and phase three, if assuming we succeed in phase one, phase two and phase three will involve many more patients.
And the way that you solicit participants in the study, do individuals come to you that are exhibiting these signs, but they're not yet medical marijuana recipients here in Connecticut?
In the first phase of the study, we are working with patients who are not naive to marijuana. So we're working with people who have used marijuana in the past, and we're simply working on pain and stress. The pain and stress are They're very clinically created, basically by putting a patient's hand in ice water. All the pain and stress we're talking about is ice water tolerance. And we will see the results we get from working with the products that we produce. The clinical aspect of this is very precise. Obviously, it's a slightly artificial setting, but again, we're working in a clinical setting under a great deal of oversight, and we're simply trying to establish safety and efficacy in a phase one, which will then allow us to do something, let's say, more practically useful, like address medical conditions that afflict Americans in Connecticut.
Well, in thinking positively for you, as I know your entire team is at CT Pharma, Mr. Schultz, I'm counting on and sort of seeing through the phase one to the possibilities in the future. I really appreciate you helping orient us on CT Pharma's role in this initial stage and being able to communicate the challenges it took to get to this point. Congratulations and continued good luck. It sounds like if yours and our best wishes come to fruition, we'll be chatting with you and your team at CT Pharma a number of times going forward as these additional studies roll out. So as you are, we will hope for the best for you, and thank you so much for being part of the program this morning. Well, we're talking to a representative of a brand new organization appearing here for the first time on the award-winning For the People, Connecticut Housing Partners. For more than a quarter century, they were known as the Mutual Housing Association of Southwest Connecticut, and they've developed this relatively new brand that better represents what they do, which is developing affordable housing and expanding reach to respond to the growing need of affordable housing throughout the state. We're talking with CEO for Connecticut Housing Partners, Renee Dobos. Renee, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. It's really my pleasure.
So we talked a bit before we turned on the microphone, and you have a career-long attachment to helping connect people to housing. You were in New Haven prior to coming to this job?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about Connecticut Housing Partners beyond that introduction. I mean, is this an organization that where people come to you, or you work with municipalities or developers? How does Connecticut Housing Partners do what they do?
Okay, sure. So first of all, I just want to let everybody know we are a nonprofit. And being a nonprofit, we're always looking for ways to partner with other companies or other individuals to help us fulfill our mission, which is to provide affordable housing. We have begun our efforts in Fairfield County. One of the reasons for our branding, renaming of our name, is because we want to expand beyond Fairfield County. So we have over 500 units of affordable housing. We're primarily in Stamford, Fairfield, Norwalk, Wilton, Trumbull, and Bridgeport. We have about 140 units that are dedicated to elderly only. We have an assisted living facility. We have family developments. We have supportive housing developments, such as for drug rehab, previously incarcerated women with children that we're giving a second chance to, and homelessness. And we really view affordable housing as that vehicle to prevent homelessness. I know everybody's very familiar with homelessness, and they understand what the homeless shelters do, but we want to be that solution before somebody loses their housing or ends up on the street. And it's really important for people to understand how important in the state of Connecticut affordable housing really is. So, for instance, our minimum wage in the state right now is about $10. They're gradually going to migrate it up to $15 an hour. The average wage that is required to rent a two-bedroom house or a two-bedroom apartment, you require about $25 an hour. So you can see there's a real gap there. And so what happens is we have households who are paying so much of their income towards their shelter that they give up things such as clothing or medication, sometimes food or other life basics are ignored because they're paying so much money for their housing. In the state of Connecticut, about 34% of our population rents. So you can imagine there's a tremendous need. And at any given time, there's about 4,000 people who are entering into our emergency homeless shelters on any given day throughout the state of Connecticut. So we really want to make people understand that it's really important to partner with us, that we're really providing a social service to prevent homelessness, because we all know how disastrous homelessness is and the crisis that it is. And we're all hearing about what's happening, you know, on the West Coast right now in California. And we certainly in the state of Connecticut, our beautiful state, don't want those kinds of problems to come to our state.
Well, while a lot of individuals who are homeless lean on and receive critical support from nonprofit agencies and some municipal organizations, it really reaches into everybody's pocket here in Connecticut when you think of the toll to the economy, because while rents seem to be escalating astronomically, and it is a benefit to the owners of these places where people are renting, it is also creating a squeeze on a huge segment of the workforce and service industries, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we're also dealing with an economic climate in which we're having a little bit of a brain drain, and people are leaving our state, especially some of our young people. And I know that the state of Connecticut is putting a task force together where they're trying to come up with solutions, because we want to keep our young people here because they're really part of the energy that's going to propel us into the future.
So a few of the things that Connecticut Housing Partners is doing to try to assist people and address particular populations, one of the items of interest I wanted to chat about was the housing segment that you have set aside for elderly folks, because while a few years ago we were talking to frontline responders to teen homelessness, I understand it's the proportion of very young people under 20 years old that had been exploding. Now we're starting to see elderly homelessness becoming a close second.
Yes, it's you know, really a crisis for folks that are reaching their senior years. And they have additional expenses that, you know, younger people may not be thinking about, such as medical expenses. And if a lot of our seniors that are retiring are earning between $800 to $1,000 a month on Social Security. They could be women that really didn't work throughout their lives. They may have been homemakers. So you can imagine if you only have $1,000 a month, where do you live? And so most of our programs that we have for the elderly, they're going to pay about 30% of their income towards rent. So if I'm earning $1,000 through my Social Security, I'll pay $300 towards rent, and therefore I have $600 where I can try to meet some of my other life needs. And then at the same time, we have resident service coordinators and programs in our elderly developments, touching our elderly residents, making sure that they're staying healthy. We try to put programs together so we can pull them out of their units. You know, simple things like exercise programs, you know, baking, whatever it takes to pull somebody out of the unit to keep them socialized, because isolation causes depression, which also impacts the health of elderly residents as well. The other thing is, with our resident services, there are a lot of programs out there. Some of the communities that we reside in have services such as Meals on Wheels. So we'll connect our residents to Meals on Wheels. We connect our residents to senior centers. We have visiting nurses coming to our developments just to do some basic screening, blood pressure, you know, checking your feet to make sure your feet are healthy or whatever it is that we feel that's needed at the time. So we do our best to connect with the community because there's a lot of social service support out there, but sometimes our residents don't always know how to find it, so we try to do that connection. And we do that at a very affordable way for ourselves because we're not able to provide those services financially, but we can hire somebody who can help connect those people to those resources.
There's also a rent bank that your organization supports, right?
Yes, I have to tell you. So, you know, in the traditional sense, we're a landlord. So this what was happening was I was starting to see that our mission, being a landlord and providing affordable housing, was conflicting with our policy. So our policies are, for instance, if you stop paying rent, then you have to go through that eviction process. And I was starting to hear some stories, and it was really troublesome to me. So I'll give you one story. I had a couple, a husband and wife, who were living in one of our developments, and the husband died. So now this household has a crisis. And when the husband died, half of that income went away because the Social Security stopped. And so now she was in a situation where she couldn't afford to live at our development any longer. And so she had a crisis. She had to move out with her son in Florida because she couldn't afford to live at our development. And an unintentional consequence was that we created another crisis. That's how I viewed it. And so I said, this is unacceptable because when a household has a crisis, whether it be to illness, you know, some of our families, they have severe illnesses such as cancer, which impacts their ability to work, or they've lost their job at no fault of their own, or, you know, a spouse dies or a wage earner in the household dies. That's a crisis, and we don't want to be an additional crisis to these households. And also, because our mission is to prevent homelessness, I certainly don't want to be putting people in a crisis in a position in which they have to leave our development. So we fundraised for about a year to make sure that we had enough funds in place before we rolled out our program. And we rolled it out to all of our residents so that they understand if you're experiencing a crisis, come to us, fill out the application, because we want to be the bridge, right? We want to help you through that crisis so that you can maintain your housing. And that is really important to us. And it's also really important for the stability of households, especially if there's households with children, so that their schooling isn't interrupted, that they maintain their stable housing and maintain their security. And so that, so we're really thinking about ways that we can help people stay housed. And so our company is a charter member of NeighborWorks. And I went to a regional conference in Rhode Island last summer, and I talked to the conference about what we were doing with our rent bank. So now I'm working with Mutual Housing Association in Hartford, and I'm also working with New Horizons in New Haven. And we're coming up together to see if there's a way that we can expand this program regionally. And we've been talking to the Department of Housing and also NeighborWorks to see what kind of critical funding that they can provide so that we can provide this program regionally, and then at the same time, not only just provide funding, but maybe have some kind of centralized location where if somebody lost their job unexpectedly, we can try to help them get another job. Because a lot of the folks that live with us, English is their second language. And I have another story. So I have a resident who had worked in a factory for many years, and English isn't his first language, and the factory closed, and he lost his job. So what he's doing now is he's going door to door, knocking on doors, trying to find a job. Well, in today's society, that's not how you find a job anymore. Everything is online. Even if you want to apply to a grocery store or Walmart, everything is online. This application process is online. So we've been trying to connect with some of the churches in our community that actually have computers and they do some basic training on how to use the computer so that we can help these residents learn the new way of how to find a job and get them connected quicker.
Wow, that's great. In the last couple minutes that we have with you, Renee Dobos, just let folks in on how much Connecticut Housing Partners and the many people that you've already assisted to obtain or stay in their homes here in Connecticut have contributed to the community. I mean, you have quality of life improvement around those homes, enhancements of the neighborhood, retention or enhancement of property values in those neighborhoods, and an amazing stat here that I'm looking at on your website, producing more than $100 million in community investments. I mean, that's not a number that, you know, that passes by without great attention.
Right, right. Well, it's exactly true. And I like to think about we change neighborhoods and we enhance a neighborhood. And I know that sometimes when you get into the suburbs, you know, we enter into the NIMBY effect, not in my backyard. And so I can tell you another story with the town of Wilton. The town of Wilton recognized that they needed some affordable housing, especially for their elderly population, because we're all seeing these market rate assisted living memory care developments popping up throughout the state. And they're really unaffordable, you know, to the you know, regular people like you and I. I mean, they're charging between, you know, $8,000 and $9,000 a month. And so, we worked with the town, and the town said, well, you know what, we have some land. We're willing to partner with you. We entered into a land lease, and this land was, you know, out of sight, by the train station, you know, on a road that didn't have any residential development. So we said, great, we'll take it. So we built phase one of 51 units of elderly independent living, and then a 5 years later, we added phase two, which is 23 units of assisted living to this development. And because we've made that investment in that area, right next door, they built a market rate apartment building complex. Through our efforts, we were able to bring a street light into the end of the street. And so now a street where really nothing was happening is now a very viable street where there's neighbors and a community living there and impacting the town of Wilton in a very positive way. Their tax base has been increased. There's more people coming to the community to shop at the local stores and, you know, and being part of that community and contributing. And we also have a very large volunteer program, and you know, we connect with a lot of the high schools because a lot of the schools have those requirements that the kids need some volunteer service. And it's so enriching when the kids and the elderly get together. We had a volunteer gala, and we had this young man speak to the group, and he said, you know, I was helping Mr. Smith, I'm making up his name, Mr. Smith, and I learned that he used to work for NASA, and he built the backpack that went on Armstrong's back, and he was so fascinated by by that. And so when you're bringing the young and old together, they just enrich each other, and that's a memory he'll have for the rest of his life.
Well, sounds like we have so much more to talk about as Connecticut Housing Partners continues its mission. I hope our conversation has reached enough ears this morning so that it can make a positive difference and maybe create an opportunity for an invitation into another undeveloped neighborhood or some other type of partnership. Renee Dobos is the CEO of Connecticut Housing Partners, creating and sustaining innovative housing, revitalizing neighborhoods, and enhancing the quality of life for low and moderate income residents all across Connecticut. We will talk to you again, Renee. Thank you so much for your time this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.